welcome to the Fantasy Wargaming podcast with me and Jake Courteen and the two other guys who are hanging around here too.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Ed.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's lovely to be part of the show.
Long time listener, first time caller.
So it's been ages since we last spoke. How are we all?
Yeah.
So what are we doing tonight, Ed?
So tonight, I believe we're talking about the background of the Infernal Dwarves and you guys, what you guys know about it, and anything you'd like to ask me, which I will stumble over answers to as best I can.
Fantastic. Now, I must admit, hand on heart, immediately, I haven't read the big book yet. It's on my list of things to do. I wanted to do it before tonight's podcast, but alas, real life got in the way. I've got an understanding of who the Infernal Dwarves were from the past, but obviously they've changed quite significantly now and they've been padded out. So I suppose kind of focusing on it, who are they? How do they fit into the Ninth Age sphere, as it were? And basically just fill us in.
Yeah, so we Infernal Dwarves obviously have certain themes that we want to convey, you know, around the kind of fire, bulls, use of supernals or teak creatures from another world. So there are underlying themes that we were always going to want to get in there. And the specifics of this predate my involvement in the project, but we took this idea of dwarves as a sort of Eastern Western split in civilizations, so cultural differences between whole dwarves and infernal dwarves that date back to long back in their history. They've gone through periods of working together and being separate, but infernal dwarves are in a sense one of the newer factions in the game, because they're defined by an event that happens in the Seventh Age, if I remember, end of Seventh, beginning of Eighth, something like that, which is where they are responsible for essentially a natural disaster or unnatural disaster. They create a device that ends up rupturing the veil, which is the division between worlds, between the mortal realm and the immortal realm, so allowing a huge flood of magic into the world, which shapes a large part of the setting as it stands. It creates the wasteland because the magical influx is sort of directed north, and therefore in the north, to the north of their lands, has created this huge magically irradiated wasteland, so to speak, and they themselves become intimately associated with the Inferno. It's part of who they are, because the concept of this is where real world concepts come in. So you have the concept of something that's very similar to Chernobyl, a potentially global defining event that is situated in one place. And then you also have the Gates of Hell, which is in Uzbekistan, I believe. It's a huge burning crater, basically. Looks like the entrance to a demonic pit, and those kind of serve as inspirations for the actual setting. And the idea being that they have created what is both a dangerous place, but also a place that really represents them and their culture in a condensed form. It's highly magical, it's highly volcanic, and really combines elements of their culture. So you on top of that, then you have the influences, Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Middle Eastern influences that set them apart from Western dwarves or whole dwarves, or however you would want to describe them. Out of that, we wanted to make a culture that was cohesive and made sense. They are providing a sort of bridging between East and West of the setting. They in many ways, they control much of the connection between parts of the setting that are further east, so ogres and various factions that live further to the east in the equivalents of India, China, those kind of locations, and then further to the west, anyone who wants to bridge that gap potentially has to interact with Infernal Dwarves. So in many ways, they're a nexus point for much of the setting, and they thrive on a kind of independence and a ability to structure a resilient civilization that can deal with being hated or being feared, or just, you know, extracting what they need from the world and not have to, and being very self-sufficient about it.
So Jake, playing ID, what kind of part does the fluff appeal to you as the army, or is it more of the play style? I mean, really, this is the fluff part of the podcast, so hopefully you're going to say fluff, but
I don't think you can separate the two, or I don't think you should be able to if they've been designed right. So I'm going to go into real world here and talk some concepts to military history, sort of theory and history of everything, which is that armies throughout history reflect the social structures of the societies they emerge from. It is very difficult to build an army that doesn't reflect the social mores and social structure of your society. What holds people in battle is the social bonds of the society around them. So if you've got an army that's, you know, very medieval feudal style, you've got, you know, upwards and downwards bonds and lots of war bands, each gathered together under an individual leader. If you've got a modern system army, for example, it's all about artificially creating those bonds via extensive training and separation from the rest of society, such that you've got soldiers as another whose primary loyalty is to themselves and their training and their esprit de corps. Or if you've got sort of citizen armies that have emerged from, I don't know, like Flemish citizen armies, for example, all of these emerge very naturally from the degree of egalitarianism or otherwise and the social bonds of their society. So if you look at the Infernal Dwarves and how they play, you've got a bunch of very proud, capable individual dwarves in relatively small numbers who are holding together a disparate empire by basically force of will and by strength. And hence you've got all these rules that pass on with each of the vassals and let them play wide as long as you play into the dwarf pieces, and the extent to which they trust, for example, the vassal chieftains that let them play further wide, it is very much a theme. And the same way the Gideon pieces that are some under control, but they need a degree of dwarven control. So you've got that feeling of, I don't know, if you think sort of Sassanid Empire or whatever, and you've got a dwarf ruler or Sassanid ruler over here who's ruling a subject nation who will then be called up to fight if necessary. And all of that's reflected in how Infernal Dwarves play on the table and how you build an army.
So focusing on that then, so fluff-wise between the Infernal Dwarves and the slaves, for example, how does that actually work within the fluff? How has that kind of transpired, as it were?
So you have Infernal Dwarves who are a faction that are running a large empire without necessarily having the sheer numbers to be able to do that through their own physical efforts. They need more input than they can generate from just their own ingenuity, their own physical capabilities. And part of that is influenced by technology and their willingness to embrace and use technology. But even with that, they then need further contributions from other people, basically. And that's where you have the two-tiered structure. You have vassals who become a relatively trusted to a degree. They become a part of the society, never being acknowledged as equals. There is a sort of supremacy of dwarvenness that runs through that culture. And I would say in their own way, whole dwarves have the same thing. It's expressed in a different fashion. It's a shared cultural trait. But for the Infernal Dwarves, they sort of deign to treat others as being worthy of some measure of respect, but it's never quite enough to make them an equal. But then they also exert their pure authority by commanding slaves to, practically speaking, slaves are not necessarily that big a part of the army. They're a much bigger part of the civilization, but equally it felt wrong not to have them represented on the table because it's such a big part of the culture that some capacity to have them on the table felt necessary just to fully reflect their culture.
If you look at this in some ways, and sorry to cut you off, Ed, but actually probably the best analogue, I think, unfortunately, plays into some rather dark bits of colonialism, which is the British Empire, and how the British Empire thought of small numbers of very technologically advanced, reasonably for the areas in which they were fighting, sort of drilled troops, fighting and supporting and supplying and training large armies of allied local forces who would align with the invaders in order to take down their local rivals. And so you see, you know, giant sepoy armies in India or various armies within Africa of different sort of African groups fighting each other, some under British banners, right? And never been quite as equal, but nonetheless given some respect and some trading privileges. And that model, I think, translates very well onto Infernal Doors.
One element that we haven't touched on is, you know, so you've got this slavery and vassals approach, but then there's the... there's the contractual and legal kind of profits of lugar and attorneys, contractual binding between citizens or whatever, which is I mean, that's something that wasn't in any of the previous games' fluff. That's something, I presume, and it's something you've brought in. Was that a means to an end, or was that something that you had in mind for the army, and then it's how it represented across?
So I think I can't really speak much to Chaos Dwarves and what existed before in terms of how they were structured for these things. But Kadeem and so Supernals in general, we tried to provide some consistency across the board. So Supernals became demons, but also everything else that could be summoned from across, from through the veil. And because Kadeem obviously made sense as having an affinity with fire and that sort of being their motif. And so summoning them required certain things to be in place, either that they would have bodies that would be formed, and we have equivalents for summoning for demons, or that they would possess someone, and we've used both things to some extent in the Demons book, so it made sense to have analogues of that within the Infernal Dwarves book. But I suppose the idea of treating with an outsider and making a deal or coming to an arrangement is obviously a very traditional one. You know, Faustian pacts is a big part of many settings. And so if you're going to have a faction that is built heavily around incorporating an external influence like that, in sort of a bigger way than almost anything that I can think of. KOE do it differently, Dread Elves do it much less. It's a big enough part of the Infernal Dwarf faction that it needs expertise to be associated with it, because that's just logical. If you're going to have that much effort put into a particular activity, you're going to get good at it. And that's where associating one of the gods, in this case the god of trickery, and trickery and law being combined in the two, I think is quite fun. But the idea being that, yes, you comply with your word in the way that dwarves, you imagine as being a typically dwarven thing to do, is that you follow what your word is. But equally, there's this superiority aspect of, well, if I'm going to obey my word's going to be more effective and more cunning than anyone else's words. So I know it at times people will take it as being slightly comical that you have any concept of law or lawyers being involved with an army setup. But you know, for it's not in these aren't intended to be lawyers wearing a robe in front of a Supreme Court, you know, shouting objection. These are people who have dedicated their lives to understanding how to bind demons to their flesh, how to enter into pacts that will bind a demon to this world, or a supernal creature, in order to fulfill a greater objective. And so if you think of any character that does that sort of function in fiction, someone like John Constantine, for example, they rely on their wits, they rely on their capability to outthink opponents, and that sort of became part of their backstory that we wanted to reflect it as best we could. And you know, there's a limit to how much you can represent all of that on the table in a game, but having nods like that, I think, adds more depth than just having they've got a bit of fire in them.
You have to think about this as a society, right? And a society that's emerged due to the societal pressures that surround it. So in many ways, I love this part about the Ninth Age world building. It's really thought out like that. The societies feel real, with all the warts and quirks and things that real societies arriving from real places are. So if you look at the Infernal Dwarfs, there's two major defining factors there: the dwarfishness that Ed's talked about, and then the influence of the Inferno. Because you take a society that basically lives all in what was already kind of a wasteland, right? They weren't exactly, they've been pushed out of where they previously lived and hemmed into a corner in the bits that nobody wanted. And I noticed this thing about great warrior races coming from wastelands, but with the exception of the nobility of step nomads, that's not really true. For the most part, powerful societies live in the places they want to live, which is the places where all the food is and all the riches are. So the Infernal Dwarfs are sat there with nothing. So how does a great empire emerge from that? The answer to that is the Inferno. They found something out there that made that a valuable piece of real estate, and then have forged that into an expansion, which again, I suppose you can draw an analogue to step nomads, and it's the same geographical set of influence, sort of, if you squint. But so at that point, you've got a society that's very defined by the sudden expansion of power that comes with the Inferno and the spread out from that, and how it takes advantage of it. So it's got to include that in the army, the Kadim being such a strong part. But then you look at the Dwarven society that's very lawful, and you think, you sort of got a classic D&D lawful evil society here. But what does one of those look like? What does a lawful evil society really look like? Because it's got a function, not just be a caricature, right? So yeah, you've got, and I don't know if I misunderstood the background there, but my understanding of law was it was somewhat split, with Asherut being the lawgiver, the seat of rightful authority, that dwarf, you know, dwarf passes law downwards. Think Hammurabi's code, very, very, you know, the ideal that the rule of law and of a structured society is a perfect dwarven thing that dwarves have built and dwarves are better at than everyone else. And so, of course, our laws are perfect. And then you've got Shamut, who both fights for and enforces those laws as the police, and also to an extent a war god. You've got Nezukesh, who deals with how that structure applies to, you know, machines in the built world. And then you've got Lugar, which is in many ways a counterpoint to that bit of society, saying that a society doesn't function when it's just all cruel, capricious law for no sake. So how does a Infernal Dwarf counterculture work? Well, malicious compliance, right? That idea of I can play the law better than you, and it's sort of weird glue that gets a society to work of, you know, what does someone who works against or in the shadows of such a society look like? What emerges in response to such a top-down society, but people who will try and twist that to their own ends? And that tying in with the Kadim elements, I think, just makes sense at that point, of that expertise of, right, well, I'm going to be the best at bargains, because and it's very clear in all those letters that are part of the Infernal Dwarf background, right? You mess up in Infernal Dwarf society, you are royally screwed, because the laws do not give an inch for mercy or forgiveness or having made a mistake. You know, your life can be over if you come on the wrong side of Infernal Dwarf law. But wherever you've got a situation like that, you've got people who are good at playing the system. And that's fascinating to me, the way that interplay occurs within the Infernal society. If I've read the background right, and this is just me as an individual reader, not someone who's been involved in writing it or creating it.
I think that's all very fair. Lugar, I think all the Infernal Dwarf and gods have an interaction with law and society in some sense, rather than there just being one, you know, god of law, if you like. So yeah.
So where are the Infernal Dwarves are mucking around with demons? Are these the same demons that are in the Demon Book, for example? Or are we talking about a different plane of...
So there are only two realms. There's the Mortal Realm and the Immortal Realm. The mortal realm is everything physical. The immortal realm is everything magical. The immortal realm has regions in much the same way as the mortal realm does. So you have hell or the abyss, as it's described in the Warrior's Book or in the Demon's Book, which is where you situate the demons who have a particular mindset that draws them to the dark gods. But there are many, many other supernal creatures out there, and we use them across the board. You know, we use them for some of the fae creatures, for Kingdom of Ectane. We use them for dread elves, for gorgons, and you know, there are varying extents to which those are summoned creatures, or they are embodied creatures that can live in the portal realm for prolonged periods. But the concept is always the same. They are creatures of magical composition in some form. In the case of the Kadeem, we took it that their affinity, rather than it being to something more chaotic as it would be for demons, rather than it being for something more nature orientated or spiritually orientated, theirs is about fire and energy and sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say destruction as such, but you know, there's an element of breaking things down inherent to the Kadeem. So it's about having different natures of creatures that are able to be incorporated into the setting, rather than everything, you know, just because it's the same makeup as a demon doesn't make it a demon, in the same way as dwarves and elves and humans are all made up of flesh and bone and blood, but that doesn't make them all the same. So
okay,
so I think one area we've skipped over is obviously where the Tarok come into it, the enforcers and anointed. And my understanding is it doesn't start with Daddy Bull and Mummy Infernal Dwarf or along those lines. So again, do you want to talk through the process?
How it's
reflected in the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jake already referenced it with briefly with the mention of Shamut. The idea being that obviously we had to think about what the Tarok are and what they represent, and they, you know, with this sort of half bull, half dwarf concept, really magic is the only thing that makes any real sense. You could be vague about it, but we tend to lean into these things and have an explanation for them. So either they are some kind of old species that comes about and then propagates itself, or they're a deliberate creation. They're a deliberate step for the Infernal Dwarves to take. And so that brings in its own dynamic, because you have to then decide, how is it that people are chosen to do this? Why is it they go through this process? What is it that these people reflect in society? And so that sort of law enforcement, bringing something that's a little bit different to the average dwarf, infernal dwarf, and reflecting something, a different part of their society, comes into play. And that's where the Tarok ritual takes us. And it also, by having that capacity for dwarves to go through it and for them to function as a member of the Infernal Dwarven Society, it then allows you to explore, well, what does that mean for a prophet or a vizier or an overlord who has undergone that ritual? And so Shamut becomes an integrated part of the society, not just an explanation for a single unit type, which is the aim, basically. Obviously, how much it's reflected on the table, I don't think we've seen that many Tauric characters in general, but certainly something that I would like to see more of.
Yeah, I'd agree. That's one area where the background and the place aren't necessarily as good a match as they are in some areas.
So, is there anything you'd like to flag up to our attention? Anything that jumps at you, or that you're particularly pleased about, or going back to the rule of cool?
I suppose I like, in some ways, I like the citizen giant. It's slightly counterintuitive in some ways that Infernal Dwarves would kind of accept someone else as being effectively an Infernal Dwarf, but in some ways it reminds me of Captain Carrot in the Discworld series, the idea that, well, of course he's a dwarf, he's just a really tall dwarf. It's the fact that someone who has undergone the same sort of initiations, and someone who has proven their worth, and maybe there's this shining light at the end of the tunnel that you could actually be a citizen of a dwarven city, and maybe it's just pure pragmatism on their part. Maybe it's just, you know what, these guys are so big and so useful, and they really buy into everything we tell them about our society. So let's get them inside the tent, and let's bring them in to be part of our society. I don't know if it's the best thing in the book, but I quite like it. I just like that idea that they've embraced this really, really tall dwarf.
About yourself, Jake, is there anything that stands out for yourself in particular?
It's something I've just covered already. I think the thing that kept me keen on Infernal Dwarves is just the way that the team seems to have done a really good job in society and background and theme meshing into the way the army plays on the table. So I feel like I'm playing a reflection of a society in a way that is more true perhaps than some of the books I've played Arnish from. And it I can sort of see the link and therefore get interested in what my units are and what they do and where they've come from within. And a little part of me is wondering if I can get a little flashing LED and build a police siren, like not into the flashing lights, into the hats of my Tauric unit.
That'd be awesome.
At which point I will make Nino noises as I charge.
Yeah,
because I am entirely mature.
How about you guys? Anything that jumps out at you from the book?
I think what you were saying about the interaction in society being reflected on the table is always a really good sign. I seem to remember, isn't there a story about the Lamassu, Temple of the Lamassu as well, that they're, they share the space with the Infernal Dwarfs, their allies, rather than, actual vassals.
Yeah, they're more than just a mount. They're more than just a kind of dumb beast to be ridden. And I think, given that there's plenty of those things in the setting, again, this goes back to sort of investigating the background of what Lamassu is, and it's been connected to the Sphinx in mythology. So there was always a connection there that this was a wise creature. This was something that had some sort of inherent wisdom that was the main drive, was to reflect that somehow. So in the book, the Lamassu actually becomes the wizard, and the rider is really a kind of slightly secondary to that, which I'm perfectly fine with personally.
Is there anything for you, Paul?
I just like the fact that although they're dwarves, they're not boring. As everybody knows, I'm a massive fan of dwarves, but I've got no issue with the Infernal Dwarf book. And I think that's a testament to the way that, like you've all mentioned, the way the background's written. I like the fact that the army is so diverse. In particular, I do like the way that their war machines or various elements of their army are possessed by demons. I think that's really cool. I like the way that they've just reached out and gone, how do we make this cannon better? I know what we'll do. We'll put a demon in it. And then suddenly it can fight in combat as well. I mean, it's just, yeah, I like the way that that's incorporated and built into the army. And yeah, just generally, I just don't have an issue playing against them on the table. And I think part of, a big part of that is the fluff that, like you've all mentioned, is represented in the way that the army is composed and built and how it plays. I think the team have done a really good job. I'm looking forward to actually digesting more of the book and finding out more about how their society functions and looking more into it now that it's all stabilized, I think. But
I will say that I'm by no means the expert in Infernal Dwarves, although I have read everything, and I definitely will not remember everything. So there are people who are definitely more schooled than I am in the specifics of how the Infernal Dwarf Society works, and you know, many people who take the time to read through it and digest it as well, which is always much appreciated.
Just out of interest, Ed, can by any chance we just slot in the dwarf book after the Greenskins and get Paul on the writing team? We'll just see whether he can fix this perceived problem. Well,
I look forward to whether we can create a dwarven society that Paul will find interesting enough to like dwarves. I will view that as a real challenge.
That is the challenge. I think it's finding a I just take dwarves. I think what was interesting though is at the beginning of the conversation, again, correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned the Infernal Dwarves didn't really exist before the Seventh Age, is that right? So before were they all just old dwarves or just different cultures?
Different culture, distinct culture, but not the culture that they end up post Inferno creation. So they are, you know, they still have those influences, those Mesopotamian, Middle Eastern influences, but they don't have the fully fledged mechanized and magical fire magic in particular based society. So there are elements of their culture that exist pre that, in the same way as makes sense for every culture, basically. You know, Sonstal doesn't become Sonstal as it is now until the beginning of the Ninth Age. KOE exists to some extent as a kingdom from a long time back, but it doesn't become KOE with knights, etc., until into the sort of Seventh to Eighth Age. So, you know, we've attempted to make the cultures feel like they are progressing through the ages, rather than, you know, there's a very heavy tendency in fantasy for tropes to play out where everything is a declining version of what it once was. It's a big fantasy trope. And we still reflect elements of that, but we really don't want that to be the defining trait of anyone in the setting, because each of us want to take one of these factions and for it to be our kind of protagonist in the game, at least for as long as we're playing them. So for me personally I don't like the idea that if I'm playing dwarves, I'm just staring down the face of an inevitable decline, and that's all that I have to worry, all I have to look forward to is a dwarf player. Yes, you can still remember past glories, and you can still hold on to elements from your past, but at the same time, we've got fantastic technology, we've got amazing things that didn't exist in the past, so therefore we're not just a static or a declining race or faction. We have hope for the future, and that's really a big part, is that while we don't necessarily have the scope to write endless novels about the next advancement and advance the setting, but we do want the factions to feel like there is a path for them to develop, and you know, anyone, the theory is any one of the 16 could be the next dominant power. It might feel a bit harder for some than others, but equally we do want that to be a sort of overall aim, that every faction should feel like it has real strengths to play on.
I feel like ID may be one of the ones that are most likely, because they are 100% written as a power on the rise, right? The Iron Road is just getting started in terms of, you know, they are effectively starting an industrial revolution. in a corner of the world where people are looking eastwards and going, well, what's going on over there, and not quite realizing what's growing.
Yeah, absolutely. But even you would say one of the more backwards factions of KOE in some ways, you know, rejecting some of the principles of plate armor or gunpowder weapons, etc., that their neighbors might adopt. But at the same time, they're still an outward-looking society. They're still driving into new territories and new places. There'll be other factions that have more historic successes that we then have to find a way to write them as being, once again, having some potential, like Saurian Ancients, for example. But that is, yeah, that is the aim, is that, yeah, I think ID are one of the more obvious ones because of how we think of the world, but equally we hope there is room for other factions to have that hope too.
No, it's Independence Day today, isn't it? The wife of the British Empire.
I go back to my Texas of Thunderbolts idea. Someone do it.
That's fantastic, guys. Well, listen, thanks very much for coming on. Really appreciate your time for all these shows. I've personally learned quite a lot. My interest has sparked with the Infernal Dwarves. I know, Tony, you've been playing with them for a little bit. Do you reckon you'll pick them up again?
No.
Oh, fine.
No, it's not that. It's, yeah, well, it's mainly because I wouldn't mind for virtual games. I'd quite like to give the Vermin Swarm a little twirl. I found Infernal Dwarfs. I found the ranges infuriating on the weapons. I've got to be honest with you. and I think where I wanted to take the army isn't where the necessarily the right way. I was basically playing it wrong, is what I'm getting at.
Fair enough.
If I can plug a side project that I'm working on within Ninth Age, which is a skirmish setting, you know, very much of the kind of Mordheim vein, I'm really looking forward to using that at some point in the mid to near future as an opportunity to take some of the small collections of models I have, and Infernal Dwarves is one of them, and have reason to paint up 15, you know, 10 to 15 models and have a play about with them. And, you know, I hope that will be a way for people to not, it won't be like playing the same game, but many of the same rules will be represented, and it might just give you a chance to experience the flavor of an army before you feel like you have to paint up an entire force of it.
I think personally, now the book's stabilized, and with the benefit of having virtual games now, I think obviously playing on the tabletop is always better, but collecting an army itself can be quite prohibitive. But with so much fun stuff in that book, I can see myself starting to play around with lists now that the army is stabilized. I think there's been a lot of criticism about how unstable the army has been, about how everything's been changing, about the walls, etc., blah blah blah. There's been a lot of negativity, but I think the strength of the current book is, well, I think we've all kind of discussed it in the earlier podcast, is that the book appears to be a lot more balanced than it ever has been. It's not dominating the tournament scene, and for someone like myself who actually takes great delight in trying to break down an army and really enjoy playing with it instead of pointing and clicking, like I love playing with the Warriors, but I actually found myself getting a little bit bored with the standard build, so I took the janky stuff with the Infernal Dwarves. But like what you were saying, Jake, I think there's a play style there for everybody. I think that's a real testament to how the book's been put together and produced, and actually you can put these units on a table and do well if you're a good player. And yeah, I think there's an awful lot that you can take out of this book and take pride in playing with it. I think, yeah, that's quite exciting. So watch this space. I might start playing around with them in 2023, maybe. I don't know. Dread Elves are appealing. But
once you've painted the rest of that cupboard of shame.
Well, as I said, it'll be an online project rather than on a tabletop. I don't ever see myself collecting them as an army per se on the table, just purely because there's dwarves in it. I can't have dwarves in my cupboard. But no, reality is I've got enough armies, and like you mentioned, Tony, my pile of shame is huge. So but virtually I definitely see myself, if there's a couple of online events, maybe rocking some Infernal Dwarves. And I think the best way of learning how to play with and against an army is to physically pick it up and learn by playing.
Yeah, yeah, we'd just like to thank you guys for taking the time to talk to us, really.
Oh, pleasure.
I know ID isn't one of the most popular armies on the table, so maybe this might spark a bit of interest, particularly the story behind it. I think sometimes people gloss over it or choose not to spend the time to go through the complete army book. But it is worth a look. As always, my favourite section's the banner section with the little stories attached to each one. So anyway, but no, thank you very much, Jake, and thank you very much, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Hopefully we'll see you on the tabletop soon.
Yeah, I'll be hard up if you're there. So.
Oh, yeah, I am actually, yes.
Awesome, I'll see you then.
Oh, good. That'll be good. Okay, see you soon, guys.
Cheers, bye. Guys.